This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Today on the show, what if your genes aren't your destiny? Our guest is Dr. Florence Comite. She's a physician scientist, endocrinologist, and leading authority on healthy longevity. In her new book called Invincible, Defy Your Genetic Destiny to Live Better, Longer, Dr. Comite explains how advances in precision medicine, diagnostics, and artificial intelligence are helping people take control of their health and aging. Through her program, she's helped thousands of patients reverse diabetes, improve heart health, reduce dementia risk, and extend their health span. We'll discuss the science behind living longer and living better. Dr. Comite, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we have, you know, been talking for a while now about lifespan versus health span. What is your definition? How do you look at health span?
Health span is maintaining your health for the rest of your life. We can never predict how long someone's life will be. But nowadays, everybody is, so many people are living till after 100. My own mother was 102. My former mother-in-law was 104. And so in order to keep yourself vital and to be part of life instead of post a stroke or on in a wheelchair or difficulty moving because you have osteoporosis or dementia, so cognition is gone, isn't it better to sort of be involved in life to the fullest? Living long, I don't know, would be such a gift if we weren't healthy. And that was always my goal. That's health span. Lifespan is what we think of it. How long do we live? And with the advent of antibiotics in the 20th century and GLP-1s now, I believe the extension is real and we're going to be living longer and longer lives, maybe to 120 or 150 in this century.
You know, I think the blue zones concept really brought the health span thing to life. And it makes me wonder if both your mother and your former mother-in-law had their own little individual blue zone that they lived in. What was their secret?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. I think determination to stay around a long time is part of it. And then making choices that feel right for you. And I think in some ways, many of us can use our instincts. We know when we may be doing something that doesn't help support us and help make us feel well. Also, I think the fact that we had access to maybe better food, food coming from the ground that was healthier because the ground was better, or we moved more because we didn't have Uber Eats and we cooked more and we were part of a natural part of relationships. I think in today's world, it gets harder and harder. We're not always in the same village as family and friends. We move around a lot. There's a plus side to that. It's great seeing the world, but we might not be as grounded. So I think there are so many reasons it's hard to pick one.
You mentioned before we went on air that you are an identical twin. And this has no doubt throughout your life made you look, probably when you were young, you looked at the differences and the similarities. And now as a physician scientist, how has that informed your work?
Basically, it's fundamental to my work because I feel what we do in conventional medicine, first, we start by practicing reactive medicine, meaning you get sick and we do something. There's the way we collect information usually starts out by getting a chief complaint. But what I saw early on in my data and work is that we begin to decline below the surface in our 30s. And in doing so, it predicts that journey you're on and what kind of diseases you're at risk for, whether it's heart attack, stroke, dementia, diabetes. And diabetes itself is ubiquitous. I mean, all of us are on the way to a form of diabetes, different depending on our gene variants, because it's also survival. So centuries ago, when our ancestors had to live through lean times, whether it was cavemen or the famine or the Holocaust, the folks who survived were those who had genes that allowed them to put weight on during the good times and live off their body. And so that's what we inherited. So in looking at N of one and determining prospectively and proactively what is going on beneath the surface. What's changing chemically and metabolically? How are you living life? There are choices we can make that switch genes on and off, a field called epigenetics. And by doing so, we evolve differently. And my identical twin and I have, to some extent, even though in pictures, I sometimes can't tell us apart, but there are distinct differences. Like, I could live on sushi and sashimi and she doesn't like fish. She's an amazing gardener. I kill plants. So not people, but plants. So those factors weighed in on me to think, how do I define who each of us is and how we then do interventions that are personalized and customized based on all those factors about who you are?
Yeah, so interesting. So what would you say would be, I mean, if you're defining your genetic destiny or your genome or your epigenetics, what are the organs that are most easily modified or malleable to make a positive outcome?
So I think that's a great question. I'm going to spin it a little to say we're living in a time when we have wearable technology. I did this work even before we had Auras or Whoops or Apple Watches, right? And could still see it in the data and in a person's health story. To begin with, all of us should try to find out what our family history is about. The family history I used to think of as a poor man's genetic test. I now know, doing very deep genetic tests, that it's also predictive of what's going to emerge. And so you can be sure that if diabetes runs in the family or heart disease or dementia, there's a good chance you've inherited some sort of genes that give you a higher risk. It's not that straightforward, but it's pretty clear. And by using your family history, which is for most of us, but not all of us, that's one great place to start. Also, knowing what our sugars are. So sugar affects every organ in the body, every cell in the body. And so by wearing a continuous glucose monitor, which has now turned to the general population in terms of marketing, because you can get one without a prescription. In earlier years, it was only diabetics and you had to write a prescription. You could see how the way you live, which, as you mentioned, in Utah, people are pretty much into longevity and being healthy and physical and outside and mountain climbing and skiing and all the rest. They could add this definite, more definitive understanding of how their own genetic makeup interacts with the way you eat, sleep, which is a huge determinant, working out, stress, anxiety, and that is a game changer. And that's where I think most of us should start.
It's so interesting because I knew that you were going to say what your favorite wearable device was. And my first guess was the Oura Ring, because we know how important sleep is. And then, no, it's the continuous glucose monitor. So this is very interesting. My doctor, who's sort of a functional medicine doctor, he said, do it once, and they normally last for 2 weeks. Don't obsess over it, but learn a lot from it. And something I learned that I wanted to ask you about is that postmenopausal women who aren't overweight, who are very athletic, quite often have a higher A1C, and almost to the point of being pre-diabetic. And I thought, well, now that's interesting. And that was kind of why I wanted to wear one. And it was very illuminating.
I would tweak what he said a little bit, or she said, in that you can't change and learn from it if you only wear it once. So one of the favorite ways, first of all, we have every patient start by wearing it. And then depending on their own inclination and what we need to study and learn, we would make some changes, maybe one change at a time, like get to sleep 15 minutes earlier, make sure that your sleep quality is good, because sleep is, as a habit, it's probably the most important one to change if sleep is elusive. But then wear it again to see where the change is gone. I have mine on. I go into withdrawal if it stops working and I have to put another one on, because I'm a data geek. But I pretty much know over the years I've driven my range to where it's optimal, which is 70 to 120. And at the beginning, you'll find this interesting, my hemoglobin A1C was always less than 5, which is optimal. But here's the issue. Hemoglobin A1C is an average of 100 days of your sugar. So your sugars can go high and it can go low, which mine did, and the average can look beautiful. And so I started recognizing that a banana alone in isolation, which is a pure carb, caused my sugar to go up to 180. When it hits 200, whether you have a high hemoglobin A1C or not, you are going to be a diabetic. And so I was very cognizant of some of the changes. And as I spoke to my endocrinology friends and encouraged them to try it so they could pass it on to their patients who were not yet diabetic or even diabetic and reverse it, they were telling me how they were planning to give a big talk and they were stressed and their sugars went sky high. And so by learning what are the triggers in you personally, which postmenopausally, one of the reasons that happens is a low testosterone. So when you have a low testosterone, you can't keep muscle on you the way you did before. You took it for granted in your 20s and maybe early 30s. But by the time we hit our 30s, testosterone's decreasing in women and in men 1 to 3% a year. We can't make muscle without testosterone, resistance, exercise, and enough protein in our diet. And those three factors have driven me to course correct my own body comp.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yes, I recently went on a trip with a girlfriend and I said, oh, let's take continuous glucose monitors and you know, so we can be doing this together while we're traveling. And
yeah.
She said, no way, we're going on vacation. We shouldn't have to you know, think about that. And I said, no, because what I've learned is it's about course correcting, like you say, not changing your diet completely.
Right.
And so it's just, it's more about, yeah, when you're getting protein and the timing of things, right? And,
exactly.
And of course, eating, if you already eat pretty healthily, you're going to be in there. So that's a really interesting point.
But you can find like out that you think you're eating healthy, but certain foods in their studies on this, the Weizmann Institute did a great study a few years ago, and it showed in one person, a banana could cause the sugar to go sky high like me, but a cookie doesn't. And the flip is true for another person. So you and your best friend may be completely different, but there are guidelines in this book that would help anybody make decisions to correct the course they're on. So for example, if you love bananas, you know, have some protein, or have nut butter before, or have a little bit of cheese, and it'll modify the rise in sugar, which it then modifies how insulin follows. And instead of going sky high, first sugar, then insulin, and then crashing, which is what happens when you do that. So then you grab a donut and a cup of coffee at 10 o'clock if you've had a banana and bran muffin, you know, at 7 or 8, you can actually keep it more even by eating protein first and modifying the release. And that's where the book, I believe, can help every one of us, even though we're all unique. So wearing a CGM, I applaud that. I do agree, though, you don't want to obsess. I get that question a lot, and I can obsess myself. But after a while, as you have a comfort level in looking at whether, you know, CGM or you add an Aura or Apple Watch or Whoop to be able to monitor sleep as well, you begin to change it. I think of it as atomic habits for longevity. You can compound changes by doing one baby step at a time and moderation, not deprivation. I'm not going to give up ice cream and cream brulee or whatever my choice of poison is from time to time. I'm just going to keep it under control and understand how my body and mind reacts.
Yes. You, the banana. Me, I met a friend. I had an empty stomach. We met at a restaurant. The food took a really long time to get there. In the meantime, I had a beer, and that beer sent me up to like 250 or something. So I won't be drinking beer on an empty stomach.
Yeah, and you look great.
Be a bad thing anyway.
No, well, you can have beer, but again, first of all, in moderation, but before you have the beer, maybe you make sure that you pop either some fiber or protein, you know, carry a little trail mix with you in your pocketbook or in your knapsack, whatever. And, you know, a mixture of like dark chocolate, yogurt, or, you know, cranberries and nuts, of course, you know, walnuts, and that alone will modify the effect beer has on your body because you look great. But that's the thing. You can be skinny fat, or you can even have a perfect body composition, but your genes genes will dictate otherwise. And I have people who are and live like that and don't know it until they study what's going on under the surface.
Mm-hmm. One more question on this. Why is it important to have protein in the first 30 minutes after waking? I've heard this.
Not necessarily. First of all, as I mentioned, here's my shake and it's in the afternoon and I still, you know, haven't really finished breakfast because I wake with a sort of a glucose that's a little on the higher side and I know I can live off of it. Other people may wake up in the morning with very low sugar, particularly if they drink some wine the night before, they go to bed too late and they have food right up to going to sleep, they eat late. Those are all factors that you can modify. But the reason to start with protein is it's the way it releases sugar and insulin. And so by having protein, whenever you start eating, because there's some people who intermittently fast, I can, but only a third of the folks I see can. A third of the folks can't fast because they wake up with low blood sugar, and a third, it has no impact. So it isn't a flat rule for everybody. That's the N of one. That's understanding my best friend, who actually you look a little like, so it's really interesting. She's Shirley McCarthy. She's an amazing doctor. She's a radiologist. And she can't get out of bed without a cup of coffee and then has to eat something. Whereas I don't drink coffee at all, and I don't have to eat for a few hours. If I want to intermittently fast, it's not difficult for me.
Yeah, it's so great to know. And this is where the whole precision medicine thing comes in, where you are tracking and all of this data and AI and all of these things that we're able to connect now give us the information that helps us apply the precision medicine. And this is what you've done in your practice.
It has. And to me, beyond the information, which you can get biomarkers here and your sleep studies here and, you know, the CGM, it's putting it together in an integrative way that allows you to extrapolate the wisdom from it and the choices you'll make to make those small changes that compound over time. And I think that is where the book can be really useful. I think that's why I called it Invincible, Defy Your Genetic Destiny, because our genes really dictate far more than we understand. I've always understood that, but the switches that allow us to make those genes operable and then to change the direction, that control could be in our hands. We don't have to obsess about it. We can touch it, understand it for a while, and then try to implement it, and then go back and do a little bit more. So if you're not living in the space, which I obviously do, and I have to, for me, that's comfortable. I don't have to worry because I really know the factors that feed into my system, right, and my patients. But if you're doing this on your own, I would encourage everybody to take baby steps and start by understanding it like you did, then go back, make some of those changes, and whether it's the banana or the beer, and then see what happens. For me, it would be the bread basket.
Yes. Well, you talk about this in your book. In part two is the 7 patterns of aging and how to reverse them. You know, the first one you mention is managing your glucose. We've already talked a lot about that, but it's this whole disorder of what you say is, you know, carbohydrate metabolism. We just eat too many carbs, right? Well, I guess, again, depending on who we are.
We eat processed food and ultra processed food, and also The Ground in America. There's some great movies. I've been in touch with some of these directors and producers called Kiss the Ground and Groundswell, where I learned a tremendous amount. And I know your show talks about so many different topics that you must touch on, environment and what's changed. We're no longer going out of our home in the morning and picking fresh fruit out of the fresh vegetables or fruit and eating them fresh from the trees or the ground. And that changes the information our body is fed, because food is stored in cold storage and then brought to market when they can get better prices for it. The ground isn't even any longer the same ground it was 100, 150 years ago. And I think by understanding there are variables we can own, those other, like decreasing processed or ultra processed food, not drinking sodas, you know, to the extent where we live on them, or but rather focusing on a balanced approach, we help ourselves survive with a health span that hopefully lasts till at least 100, maybe 120 or 150, as we talked about earlier.
I love it. One of the things you talk about in the book, and there's so many, I could talk to you all day, but one of the aging patterns has to do with our muscles and bones. How to build your muscles and bones. Most of us know that, you know, we need resistance training and strength training and things that will even create some impact. But could you go into that a little bit? And what is sarcopenia?
So I'll start with that because it's the definition. Sarcopenia is too little muscle. Sarco is muscle and penia is too little. There's also osteopenia, which is the same thing. And you're on your way to osteoporosis when you have osteopenia or too little bone. Bone and muscle continually turn over and we can grow it through our lifetime. We can change how much we have. I'll use me again, as an example with my twin. So I knew osteoporosis or thinning bone was very prevalent on both my mother's family and my father's. I had an aunt in each one, a maternal and paternal, who died because of osteoporosis. And so I knew many years ago when I started this work and I started Women's Health at Yale in 1992, I started taking testosterone. I don't have osteoporosis. My twin does because she didn't start until she's been on it half the time I am. Taking testosterone. So that and eating enough protein, because you need protein to build bone. So having at least 1 gram per kilogram, which is 2.2 pounds of body weight a day, is going to help you maintain bone. Now, if you're super, super active, you want to go up to 2 grams per kilogram, or let's say 1 gram per pound, as opposed to 1 gram per 2 pounds. So if you're 100 pounds, at least 50, and even up to 100, depending on how much workout you do. And that will build your ability to make muscle, which protects you from sugar. So think of it as a way to burn energy. And also it packages sugar in your body and releases it when you need it. And then of course, finally, you want to do that resistance training to build bone along with some aerobic, move around, cardio zone two, as well as high intensity interval training. And together that will complete the package to protect bone and muscle, because muscle packages bone. And if we have strong muscle, if we have a fall, it's going to protect us. So we want that muscle and we want to protect it for life.
Yeah. You make some really good connections. For example, you talked about how if you don't have testosterone, your A1C, your hemoglobin A1C could be off. And I wanted to ask you about chapter 6 is strengthening your heart. It's about cardiovascular disease. It seems like there are, you know, the whole world's on a statin, right? And, you know, are there ways that you present that are like, well, if you do this and you, you know, if this system is functioning more, or if you take this, then you probably won't have to take, you know, so many statins.
Remember that all of us are programmed with certain genes, and there are genes that we can test, and we do. We test thousands of genes in our patients that show us the propensity to go in one direction or another. For example, and this is not heart, it's eyes. I have a gene for macular degeneration, and I found out that by having too much vitamin A, which sounds counterintuitive, it actually precipitates macular degeneration. Wow. Whereas you need a lot of vitamin D. So making this analogy to the heart, the way we want to protect our heart is the same way we protect our body, because heart disease is ubiquitous. And it goes back to stick with women. The same is true of men, but earlier, actually, they get heart disease before we do, about 10 years. We get loss of bone before they do because they have more testosterone, but we have more estrogen and it's actually heart protective. So what you want to do is make sure that you're doing all the right things to decrease inflammation in your body, to make sure you're eating the way we talked about, that you're not drinking as much. Genetically, if you are pre-programmed, then you might have to use supplements or medication, because we are not going to, Father Time isn't as kind to us as Mother Nature. And so deterioration happens. Some people, I think, believe that you should let nature take its course, but I feel like nature taking its course meant in prior generations, you died at 40 to 50. So what was the big deal, right? You were kind of through your useful reproductive lifespan and that was it. But now we extend that. And in order to make the most of it, I think we have to take care of ourselves in somewhat different fashion and focus on what is important, what runs in our family. Let's stop that in its tracks so that we don't have to worry about a statin for, you know, our whole life if we don't need it.
Yes. Dr. Florence Comite, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Your book is so well laid out. Part one, The Truth About Aging. Part two, These Seven Patterns, and we talked about a lot of them and how to reverse them. And part three is extending your health span. And this is all around sleep, nutrition, fitness, and all of that. Thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation.